This podcast is brought to you by Vertex. Guys, please go over to www.vertex.com. Vertex is a technical clothing company, technical backpack company, and they make a whole variety of backpacks and range bags, everyday carry bags, and pretty damn good clothing. In fact, I actually have a pair of Vertex pants that goes back to 2016. I wore them on a pilot episode for a TV show that I filmed for the History Channel back in the day. I took them through the desert. I've tried destroying these pants just by wearing them through briars and all sorts of stuff, and they just keep coming. They might have a whole bunch of pine sap on them, but hey, they still keep me covered and decent. Guys, if you go over to www.vertex.com and you use the code FIELDCRAFT, that's FIELDCRAFT, you can get 20% off of your order. While you're there, take a look at the Tactigami. That's the folding fabric that you can use to create mag pouches, radio pouches, all sorts of accessories on the inside of the packs. It's pretty cool stuff. I'm a big fan of their dedicated magazine pouches for the range. I have one loaded up anytime I go, just so I don't have to jam mags at the range. So guys, please go over to www.vertex.com, check out all the stuff that they have, and do not forget that code FIELDCRAFT to get 20% off your order. Thank you for listening to the FIELDCRAFT Survival Podcast. I'm Kevin Estella. Just want to give a quick shout out to the Sig Sauer Academy and Sig Sauer. They're one of our sponsors here at the FIELDCRAFT Survival Podcast. And Sig is one of those awesome companies that I've really enjoyed working with over the years. Even before I joined the ranks of the FIELDCRAFT Survival crew, I was going up to the Sig Sauer Academy back in 2015 and training up there. Guys, if you can't train with us at one of our locations, go up to New Hampshire, go meet the folks from the Sig Sauer Academy and train with them up there. There's a lot to do in the live free or die state. And I'll tell you, you can make a weekend out of it. So you show up the night before, you do your thing, go out to dinner, take the wife or the husband, whatever you got. And the next morning, go out, get a good breakfast, train, go to the experience center, get a good meal at Goody Cole's, go stay at the Exeter Inn, great place, and just really just enjoy that area. New Hampshire is one of the greatest states to train in, super friendly people, and I think you're really going to enjoy training at the Sig Academy. I've been there probably 24 times in my lifetime, and I've done everything from the pistol classes to the carbine classes, the defensive shotgun courses, and the precision rifle courses. Probably the most fun you're going to have there is bullets on vehicles, where you do a lot of ballistic training through glass and into vehicles. And probably one of the most important classes you will ever take is the 3-day precision rifle class, because it will make you a better shooter across every platform. Not to mention you get a chance to shoot out to 1,000 yards. Sig is really, really raising the bar, you can say that, with the experience center. I mean, they've got a museum there. They have an indoor shooting range. The pro shop is a place where you can spend a lot of money, so just be real careful. And while you're up there, look for, you know, some of my good buddies that are up there in the instructor cadre. If you see Cav, tell him that you got Cadbury eggs, and I'm sure he'll do all sorts of things for you, helping you out with, you know, your skill set on the range and all. So guys, please check out SigSauer.com. And please check out the Sig Sauer Academy. And by the way, that is how it's pronounced, Sig Sauer. It's not Sig Sauer. And I think you're going to have a great time. So, all right, guys, thank you so much for listening to the FIELDCRAFT Podcast. Until next time.
Hey, guys, Mike Glover, Wolf 21. I want to talk to you guys today about our mission statement, which is to provide natural supplementation and improve your health and well-being. Everything from CBD and CBN in combo to get a good night's rest, to RUCKUP for first responders who can't have anything with THC in it. We're always trying to innovate to provide natural supplementation, and that's our mission. We want to do what nobody else is doing and provide a full spectrum of options from Wolf 21. So go check it out. The link's down below, and I appreciate your business and appreciate your time. Thanks, guys.
Hey guys, welcome to the FIELDCRAFT Survival Podcast. I'm your host for this episode. My name is Kevin Estella. I'm one of the survival guys here at the company. I'm just going by that now because we wear a lot of different hats, but everyone just says, oh, you're the survival dude. And it's like, it's way easier than saying director of this or whatever. So guys, awesome podcast today. I'm looking forward to this one. I am just coming back from a trip out to Colorado. And out in Colorado, I taught a basic survival class out there as well. Modern survival skills and a basic shotgun course. We got to get the names right. So if you guys are looking for those courses online, you'll be like, oh, that's the class he was talking about. Just got back from Colorado. I love traveling out to Colorado, training out in Colorado. It's always near and dear to my heart because skiing out in Colorado is amazing. The fishing out in Colorado is absolutely, absolutely incredible. And I've traveled out to Colorado a bunch, but this was my first time traveling to Colorado to actually train with our cadre of instructors out there. And over the 3 days that I was out there, I flew out on a Friday. I trained Saturday, Sunday, came back just yesterday. Yesterday was Monday. I hung out with the two Matts and Eric. Well, I have one of the Matts with me. That is Matt Shea, or I don't know if he wants to be called Matthew Shea, all fancy, but I got Matt Shea on the phone with me, and we're going to just talk about training and this past weekend and all that great stuff. So hopefully you guys will get out to Colorado and train with him. So shout out to the Colorado crew, but also guys, train anywhere you can in the country with us, whether that's here in North Carolina, Colorado, Arizona, Utah, or wherever we may be. So with that long-winded intro, Matt, how you doing, buddy?
I'm doing great. How's it going?
It's going fine. I got in very, very early yesterday, considering like many times I come in, it's midnight or 1 o'clock in the morning by the time I finally like crash in my bed. But I actually got in, I ate a calzone, ate way too much of it way too quickly, but you know, I'm doing okay. I jumped on the scale. I didn't really gain any weight or lose any weight. I'm holding steady at 215. I'm happy. So I guess that's way more information than you wanted, but I am freaking caffeinated right now after just doing another podcast. So how are you doing?
I'm doing good. That was a busy weekend. So spent all day yesterday trying to catch up on house chores and getting back in the groove to go to work today, but it was great. I had an awesome weekend training with you and definitely failing at a couple things. I think I finally got my water boiling last night on that fire and putting gear back together after the women's only personal defense, which was awesome. And, you know, you got to catch up on laundry, catch up on house chores. My wife had me putting together a 100+ piece set of table yesterday. So
that's the honey-do list.
Yes.
Yeah, the honey-do list. So let's kind of talk about the whole weekend because there's... You know, I just got a question that I answered in the podcasts and questions or coffee and questions podcast about traveling to train. And if you are going to travel, Colorado is a great place to travel to. Flying into that airport, I flew in on Friday. My flight got delayed in Austin, but I got in. I had no trouble getting to the hotel that I stayed at in Parker. But Colorado is hungry for training. And there were a couple guys in the training crew. The students, one of the guys was like, I've taken 23 classes at Fieldcraft Survival. I'm like, damn. So what can you say about the just Colorado in general for people who have never been and they might be kind of reluctant to go there? What can you say to sell the state as a place to train?
As a whole, I think, like you said, our Colorado crew is deep. We probably have, I would say, 10 to 15 folks who I see all the time. They are dying to learn. They come in and absorb everything. They put out every single time that they come. And also, you know, it's nice because everybody starts seeing each other and it is that tribe aspect. I mean, we have celebrated birthdays on the range of these folks who have come in and dedicated, you know, like you said, 20 weekends of their time to come and train with us. And it really is that tribe. I know occasionally people will question the weather out here in Colorado. We have held classes in, I think the coldest we had was like negative 14 when we started, and it was a balmy like 5 degrees throughout the day. But any given day throughout the year can either be cold or hot. You know, I think we had great weather on Saturday.
Oh, yeah.
It was what, 45, 50. And we had a couple folks down to t-shirts by the afternoon. So I think that's probably one of the things that that will scare people off for us is that cold weather. We do try to minimize some of the classes in the kind of more sketchy months, you know, that winter time where you just don't know what you're going to get. We do limit those classes, but also when it is that freezing cold temperature and everybody's standing around the burn barrels on the breaks and trying to catch up, I actually think that those are some of the better classes. Mm-hmm. Those are the ones that, you know, what is that, shared misery?
Yeah. You know, yeah.
It brings people together and everybody has fun. It's, you know, it's type two fun for sure. but it's just great training out here. I mean, maybe I'm biased because, you know, I'm from here, but I love the Colorado classes. Love seeing the people, love the range that we're at. We have a great facility. Dave, the range owner, he is so helpful. I love teaching with my friends. I love meeting new people. It's just great.
Yeah, let's talk about that location. So Dave Mason is the man behind ModTac, and you know, it was awesome. You picked me up from my hotel on Saturday and you're like, yeah, you're about 30 minutes away, 20, 25, whatever minutes away. And we drive out there. And the first thing I said to you, I think, was, man, this looks like Red Dawn, you know, and I'm known for making a whole bunch of like cheesy 80s references, you know, but we get into this location where ModTac is, and he makes these like high end carbon fiber suppressor covers. And he's a former tier one dude. And what a nice guy, like very welcoming. You know, the classroom could hold about 10 to 12, maybe 12 if you're really friendly. But the facility was amazing. Like he has his private range. You could hear people shooting in the distance, but just having privacy. And also he's not one of these guys as like a host who is like, I have to be there looking over your shoulder and make sure guys aren't screwing with me. Like you guys have fostered such a good relationship with him where the range looks better when you leave than when you get there. And I'm not saying when you get there, it's a piece of shit, but you know, you get there and like, I didn't have to ask twice for the students to help me pick up shotgun shells on Sunday. It was kind of like they just knew to do it. And I mean, even his like stewardship for the range, he's like, yep, burn barrel. That's paper and cardboard only. We're not burning plastic in there. Like, you know, maybe that's a little true to Colorado form, you know, a bunch of environmentalists, or maybe that's just him not wanting to burn stuff. I don't know. But what a good host and a great facility.
Dave is such a great dude. I mean, he makes sure that we have what we need and he'll check in on us, you know, give you a text or a phone call, making sure that everything is smooth. If we need help, he jumps right on it. We have pretty much everything that we could ask for out there, while kind of keeping it rustic. I don't know if the right word, but you know, you feel like you're out there and you can do a lot of stuff, you know, and put your imagination to it and you can make some really cool courses out there because it has the space, it has the ability to, you know, you're not confined to like a 10 lane shooting range or something like that that you might get in something that's more overdeveloped in some ways.
Yeah, you know, I enjoyed teaching the survival stuff out there and we flexed with what we had. I mean, it's maybe not the ideal environment for teaching true bushcraft where we're utilizing saplings and we have a forest to work with. I mean, it's an open high desert field. Maybe we'd move to resources, which is a survival concept. But for land nav, makes sense out there. Shooting makes sense out there. If he allowed like an overland event where you pull up in your vehicles and you hang out and you cook out and shoot guns, like that would be a great location for that. But yeah, what an awesome, awesome place. And like you said, the Colorado crew that's there, they're hungry. They, you know, showed up and it was funny because when a couple of guys pulled up on Sunday, you and, you know, Vandy were teaching the women's class. I was there with Eric, but these guys pull up and they're like, hey, you know, like they knew one another when they were getting out of the cars, you know, and they knew the rigs that each other was driving. And it was just so damn good. Like it just felt good to teach there. And I'm very jealous because, you know, you've got I love North Carolina, but you've got like the foothills everywhere. You got mountains everywhere. You got snow cap. Like it looks so damn cool when you're training out there.
Yeah. The scenery is top notch. And you know, and Vandy, he's the original Colorado guy, and from the start, you know, they really started trying to build that community out here. And when everybody else came on, it's, you know, it is just that, like, you know the guys, you know their trucks. Certainly there's definitely truck envy for sure. You see these guys rolling up and they're ready to train, and it's great.
So let's kind of hype up Vandy a little, because I know he's gonna listen to this, as well as Eric. If you had to say,
I'm gonna make fun of both of them.
I know. And that's why I'm asking this question. If you had to say three nice things about Matthew, Vandy, and then Eric, what would those three nice things be?
Three nice things. I will tell you. So for both of them, they are both exceptional teachers and shooters. They really have gifts for conveying that knowledge and making people better. Vandy is massively dedicated to the craft and to the process of making the classes as good as humanly possible. And I will tell you that, having worked with both of those guys for, I think I've worked with Vandy in some capacity for coming up maybe on 18-ish years, and Eric about 10. These are guys that I 100% have trusted my life to, will trust my life to, and trust them emphatically.
Yeah, I think, I had a chance to talk to both of them. And what I like about both of them is that they like staying current. You know, Vandy was talking, on the drive back to the airport about his social media and what he posts. And he's like, look, I don't always post SIG. He's like, yeah, we do stuff with SIG, but he goes, I post the guns that I actually carry concealed. He's like, I did a bill drill with my 43X, and he's like, I'm trying to do what most people out there are doing, And I'm like, that's really cool, because it's got to be real. And he's always striving to, again, be current. And someone pointed it out. Shadrick pointed it out on Saturday. He said, when you go to certain training events, sometimes you go with someone who just will show you how to teach. Then you go sometimes and you train with people who have been downrange and have used the skill set in real world scenarios. And then sometimes you go and it's just for the experience. Like, that you're probably learning dated content. You're just going to hang out with a personality. When you go and you train with Vandy, you're getting two out of those three. I'm not saying that he doesn't have a personality, but I don't think he wants to tell a whole bunch of cop stories. He wants to train, he wants to grind. And then the same thing with Eric. Eric and I were BSing on the trip to the range on Sunday. And he's telling me about, his background as a college wrestler and how he teaches takedown classes once a week at the local jiu-jitsu school and how he's broken his toe a bunch of times. And I was like, dude, I've separated ribs and broken hands, and like we were talking about just injuries and how they make us old people slow and whatnot. But one of the things that was really cool about him, I had just shown a couple drills on Sunday, one of them being the select slug, and we showed a couple different ways, one being the download one. So if you have a shotgun that's technically 6+1, you only load it to 5. And then that way you can always load around in the tube, rack the slide, or run the bolt, and you now have a slug. Or there's the dump method where you rack this, rack the forend, dump the round on the ground, and then load another slug in. And that's taught with a lot of different shotgun platforms. And he pulls me aside. He goes, hey, I learned another way where you put your thumb up here and you save one of the rounds. And the way that he did it was so cool, because, many times instructors will try to, they kind of cannibalize their own ranks, and he could have easily said, hey guys, there's a better way of doing it, and now made me look like a joker. And, whether you do it one way or the other way, at the end of the day, however you get the round in the tube, I'm happy as long as you get the round in the tube quickly and you can put it down range. But I like the fact that as an instructor, he had the respect to pull me off to the side and say, hey, this is how we do it. And then I told him, I'm like, hey, we show it this way because it works across all platforms. And sometimes you can't get your finger up in there. You do have to dump, And he's like, oh, okay, I get that. But what I liked about him was that he was super professional. Both of those guys, all of you guys are pros. And that's uncommon when you go to certain shooting schools and whatnot, where you can tell the instructors are like jockeying for, hey, let me talk. I've got an ego. You know, like you guys are just want to get the skills out there. You want to get the students to level up. And I appreciated the heck out of having both of you guys there on Saturday and Sunday to just be there and help me out. And, you know, I'm looking forward to, if I'm allowed to go out there, you know, I know we're limiting the flights, but if I can train out in Colorado, I want to take your mid-range class and, you know.
We'd love to have it. Yeah, I mean, those guys, Eric is one of the most humble people I'm around on a day-to-day basis. Like, he keeps quiet. He's like, he's pretty reserved, very, you know, he'll sit back and listen and watch. You know, no matter what you're talking about, if you're talking about, you know, shotguns, or you're talking about, you know, doing takedowns, he'll sit and watch. And you know, little do you know, he is a beast. I give him a hard time all the time, but yeah, he'll beat the crap out of me if I push him too hard.
So I want to dive now into you, because, you know, one of the things that happens at Fieldcraft every so often, you know, like every so often a product will kind of outshine the people at the company. And I think people first when it comes to a company, like that's my leadership style. Like if you elevate the people, the products will follow, you know. And if we're trying to sell products, which that's one of the things that we do, look to see what the trainers are carrying, look to see what the people who we respect, and look at the people who we put in charge to elevate the students, look to see what they're using, and that should drive, you know, products eventually. So many times our products, then there are some cool ones, get the press, but you guys don't. So I'm curious, I want to do a deep dive now into who you are, where you came from, and all that great stuff. Because we had an amazing meal after the course. I had shrimp tacos. Yeah. You had some type of chicken sandwich that looked fried and fatty and delicious. And
it's delicious. Yeah. Nashville Hots.
Nashville Hots. Yeah. So, where the heck do we begin with you, other than where did you grow up and how did you become a cop?
So I grew up in Southern Illinois, in a town called Carbondale. My parents were both bankers. My dad went on to be a stockbroker, and my mom ended up starting her own bank eventually. But that's where I grew up. Both my parents had moved over there from Central Missouri, so like really small town folks. And grew up my whole life there in Southern Illinois. It's like a smaller college town, so that was kind of an interesting mix of people. You know, we had folks from all over the country and actually the world coming to that school, but it is, you know, very, you know, the surrounding area is very classic middle America, small town life. And why did I become a cop? You know, my mom's father was a sheriff in Central Missouri back in the like late 60s, 70s. So he was a sheriff of probably, I had to guess, maybe a 20 or 30 person department back in the day. So I used to hear tales about like my grandmother cooking for the inmates, and they lived in a house that in the living room, you open it up and you were in the sheriff's department. So my mom and her family, you know, basically shared a wall with the sheriff's department while my grandfather was the sheriff. So I grew up, he passed away when I was very, very little. Like my only real memory of him is sitting on his lap in his patrol car and him letting me turn on the sirens. But I grew up seeing his photo in the house and some of his gear. He was a judge for a while, so they had his gavel sitting kind of next to his photo. And that was kind of one of my driving forces, is I wanted to be, you know, I wanted to live up to that image. I wanted to be that guy. So growing up as a kid, I mean, cops came out when I was, you know, really young. And even, you know, even in the days of being a teenager, wanting to go out and hang out and party with my friends, I always made sure to watch my Cops on Saturday night before I went out.
So, all right. Since you're tailing off the story there, I got to ask you a Cops question. Do you have a favorite episode of Cops? And why is it the episode where they find the guy with the spray paint silver or gold on his face?
You know, I don't know if I have a favorite one. I think I've watched, you know, watched them all on reruns for years and years and years. So they all start to blend. I think the spray paint question, I think, is that the silver and gold have what, like a higher concentration of whatever it is that that affects you when you huff paint, is what I've heard, is that's why you're always catching folks with the with those certain colors. But thankfully that's tailed off in this day and age, because I think that rots your brain like pretty quickly.
Yeah, I think Steve-O was high on huffing keyboard cleaner. So random reference to Steve-O from Jackass. But I remember watching that episode and I was like, number one, the dude was like, I'm not using paint to huff. And his whole mouth was covered in that. It was either silver or gold. I don't remember. But I was like, oh my God, that was the first time I ever saw that you're probably your age, kid or teenager. I was like, oh my God, well, like they do that. Like, you know, that blew my mind.
That's the thing about this job, is that you see stuff all the time and you're like, what is wrong with people? You know, I always tell people when I'm training like new folks, you know, when they come in, I'm like, hey, you know, you just got the ticket to the biggest show in life, right? Like, you're going to see stuff that you would never see in any other profession, you know, good, bad, and otherwise. Like, you're going to see the extreme ends of what people are capable of.
So speaking of which, you know, they say that between nurses, teachers, and police officers, there is definitely no way that the alcohol business is going to go out of business, because many of those teachers, nurses, and police officers self-medicate with alcohol. And it's usually because of the stress of what you've seen on the job. When have you found those moments to be the greatest? Like, what is the most stressful part of your job? And do you have one moment that stands out where you said, damn, I'm lucky to be alive?
You know, I think probably the moments I can probably only speak for the police side of things. Mm-hmm. I know, especially in the last couple of years, it's a very hard balance between what the expectations of the public are, what the expectations of, say, your organization is at a higher level, and your ability to balance both of those in the sense of like on the street with the people that you're encountering, right? So I do think in the proliferation of everybody, I mean, there's high scrutiny in police work, right? The proliferation of cell phones, body cameras, all those things where people can kind of see what's going on. I think the stress of people looking at police work and saying, well, you did this wrong, and the Monday morning quarterbacking, and the idea that like at any moment you could be the subject of, you know, you go viral or whatever you want to call it, right? You're nationally known for something that you really had very little control over, but somebody has a cell phone camera. I think that wears on people right now. I think the idea that, I think that maybe the best analogy is that, like, I don't know that police work has changed a ton, at least how you have to handle certain circumstances, but people are seeing how the sausage is made. You know what I mean? Mm. And taking down somebody who doesn't want to go to jail, arresting somebody who's committed a crime, or at least you have probable cause to believe that they committed a crime, and they need to be, you know, arrested, processed, you know, given all their due process and put in jail, and that person says, no, you're not going to do that to me, and I'm willing to fight, or I'm willing to resist, that is an ugly process. And people can now see what that looks like, you know, from a computer screen 10,000 miles away, and they have the ability to kind of put forth their own opinion on, well, you could have done this better, or you could have done that, or just like, oh my God, why are they, you know, taking this person to the ground over nothing? That, I think it's good that people can see that and can see how people are behaving to receive that sort of result or that sort of action. But that is a heavy burden to bear, to know that, like, you could, by no choice of your own, end up in that situation where you've got to take action. And now it is national news. And, you know, whether or not you get backed by your community, your organization, whatever, I think we've seen nationwide where you get one side of a video, you don't get a full story, and I mean, you can chop up stuff no matter what the true story is or what your perception of the event was, and it can just look bad for you and really cause you some turmoil in your life. For law enforcement, I think that is a huge stressor. I think, you know, kind of battling those things out, whether or not, like, you have administrative stress that weighs on you. I read a thing the other day that said, like, your average person deals with like 4 or 5 what they would call like massive traumatic events in their life, whereas somebody who's a first responder, you know, medical, paramedic, firefighter, police officer gets 400 to 600.
Wow.
And if you don't have coping mechanisms, right, that kind of stuff can eat you alive.
Damn, I didn't know it was that high. I mean, I know, you know, plenty of police officers see terrible things on a regular basis, especially motor vehicle accidents, and especially when the victims are like the helpless. Like, some of the stuff that I've heard from friends who are on the job, I'm like, damn, you guys don't get paid enough, you know? And unfortunately, we are in a society right now where police officers are so easy to blame. You know, people are like, oh, it's the cop's fault. It's the cop's fault, you know? And it's like, no, there's a breakdown a long time ago. Probably started with the parents, but let's move away from that for a second. You brought up something that I think is really important to talk about. And we just discussed this earlier, you know, scrutiny from a training perspective. It's so important that we take our training seriously, because it's so easy to get into a class where there are airsoft guns, or there are Sims guns, or there are live firearms. And everything that you say in a class, you might say, oh, it's just training. It's just make believe. I've heard people say that before. It's like, oh, this isn't real. Yeah. It's like, well, you know what could be very real is, let's say that you do need to use your training. Eventually, the prosecutor, if there are ever charges held up against you, they're going to find anything that you've said. They're going to investigate you, you know, inch by inch, looking back at your history of social media, where you've trained. They're going to ask people like, okay, did they say anything ridiculous in training? Did they do anything? Were they trigger happy? Like, all the words that people like using with the, you know, in the anti-2A community. How do you feel about that when, like, you see a student who isn't necessarily being safe? Like what's the role of the trainer to get people to take it seriously? Like, how do you drive home the importance of taking your training seriously, because it could save your life in more ways than one?
You know, I think it's incumbent upon us as the trainers to explain the why, right? Like, so, you know, they maybe signed up for our personal defense class because it just looks fun. I mean, it is an awesome class. It is a fun class. But if you're not there to look at these scenarios and be realistic with yourself and put yourself in that scenario, and you just, you know, let's say you shoot the role player just because you wanted to shoot a Sims gun at a role player, the ramifications of that, right? Like, one, you don't get the good training rep, right? You don't get the, you know, the Rolodex marker that says, when I'm in X situation, I can do, you know, these couple of options. So you have a bad training rep or a training scar in that mode. But also, I do think if you're not taking it seriously and you are that, you know, kind of trigger happy, I don't care, I'm just going to shoot everybody, I mean, I think there's so many cases where people's attitudes on those kind of things comes through. And I mean, that could be the tipping point in a trial, or be, you know, a prosecutor deciding to charge you, as they look at your training record, or they look at your, basically your whole life, and they say like, yeah, this person was just out there looking for trouble, because, you know, we went and talked to these people because on his social media he had, you know, these friends that they had trained with, or this company, or whoever. And everybody said like, yeah, he was just like joking around about, you know, shooting people and didn't take it seriously. And then sooner or later, I do think that there's going to be a moment where there is a person that they look at and they're like, that is eerily similar to the event that occurred here. And mm-hmm. you are going to hate life if that's how you handled your stuff. But if you were in a class and they look at it and they're like, yeah, this person is doing the best that they can to be a responsible citizen. They were trying to understand the laws as, you know, as best as they were able to. The trainers did a good job. You know, that's incumbent upon us as trainers to provide them with the best level of training, best knowledge that we can provide those students to help them make decisions. And, you know, they did everything that they could, and they tried their best to do the right thing. I mean, that's going to work in your favor every time. The person who comes in and just, you know, laughs and jokes, and you know, it's like if you're running through a shoot house and you hit the hostage, right?
Mm-hmm.
You can't laugh that off. That, I mean, that has to be, you know, and I've seen, and I've certainly been guilty of it myself, is that you're like, oh man, that I just really screwed that up. My bad. You know, like if you just take light of it, you're like, man, that's not good. We have to do better. Maybe I got to slow down. Maybe I've got to do whatever changes I need to do. But as teams and organizations and people, we have to look at a failure and take our training seriously. And if we're not taking it seriously, we're not going to get better, and we're setting ourselves up for failure.
Yeah. There are two points I got to make based on that. Not taking things seriously. So on Sunday, part of every basic shotgun class, one of the things that we do is buckshot patterning, where I say, all right, guys, you have 8 or 9 pellets, double op buck, that's going down range. And up close, you're going to probably keep all 8 or 9 on your target. But at some point, somewhere around the 15 to 20 yard mark, you're going to start dropping pellets. And each one of those pellets is roughly the size of a 9mm round, and it's traveling in excess of, you know, 1800 feet per second, probably around 1600 feet per second. And at one point on Sunday, one of the guys was like, you know, he dropped a pellet, and I think it was probably at 20 yards. He goes, oh, it's just one. And I said, there's a lawyer attached to that, you know. And it's the whole idea, like, don't, like, you should know now, like, your shotgun is, with that ammo, is a 20 yard gun. It's, or maybe a 15 yard gun, but it's not a 25. And, you know, I think to your point about, you know, like the narrative and how like a prosecutor is going to use your training against you, you know, what we can do to get ahead of that narrative is to say, listen, I don't train to take lives. I train to preserve them. I carry a pistol every single day, not because I want to get into a gunfight, or, you know, I have this idea that I'm, you know, a gunslinger. I carry a pistol because it's a very effective way with training to preserve my life when someone is trying to take it, or the life of someone I care about, you know. And unfortunately, there are people out there who will say, well, I carry a gun because someone does something, I'm going to smoke them or whatever. And it's like, think of the second, the third, the fourth order of effects of your actions, and get ahead of the narrative. Make sure that you are being truthful with yourself and with what you're saying. And in a very, very interesting way, I'm going to make this a segue into something else that you do. Many times when people see the tools that we carry and the tools that we employ, they think, oh, they're just trying to take life, take life, take life. I heard from a good friend who's also a SWAT guy. He said, listen, the SWAT team's not there to, you know, just go in and kill a whole bunch of people. The SWAT team's job at the end of the day is to preserve life. And there are two things that you do that I think are very interesting in that life preserving role. One is SWAT, and the other, I don't know if your department wants you to use police marksman or sniper or whatever, but that role can save life with one round as opposed to going in risking the lives of so many others. So let's talk about those two things that you do in addition to standard police work. How did you get onto the SWAT team? And when did you make that jump to the police marksman or sniper?
I was probably 4 or 5 years into my career when I really started trying to get onto our SWAT team. And I think immediately I wanted to get onto our sniper team. That was just an interest that I had. So when I went through the academy, one of my, if you want to call them drill instructors, was a sniper on the SWAT team. Our SWAT team is a collateral duty team. So that's part-time. I think that's probably most of the organizations in the country. But he was on the SWAT team, and he is just, give him a shout out, Mark DeReza. That guy has been to more training and knows more about most things than I will ever probably know. He is like dedicated to being better at everything. He was a mentor for me. He is a mentor for me. I'm actually going to meet him today to do some training. But he helped me. I went out, I think most ways, most teams, you kind of start out by, showing up, showing the interest and getting shot at and, playing the bad guy over and over and over again. So when I did finally get selected, I think within a couple months, I was able to secure a spot on the sniper team. This is probably, it's been a while, so I can't quite remember the days, but, that was just an early desire to get on that team. We do a little bit more training, than the rest of the team, just cause it is that specialty skill, and you've got to be, at least on our team, you've got to be prepared to do everything from being a salter, doing room clearances, to being a sniper, out in a hide, making those decisions, giving those observations.
Okay. Now I got to ask you, because there are going to be guys out there that are like, all right, I got to know what he carries. So on the job, and off the job, what are the firearms that you carry? And is there any equipment that you're like, damn, this is the next best thing that everyone should be aware of?
So my day-to-day, like my duty gun is a Glock 19 with an RMR. I just recently in the last couple of weeks went from I used to carry just a kind of more stripped down, Glock 19 is my EDC, type carry gun. And then just recently went to a Glock 48, just as my kind of day-to-day carry gun. I also carry a BCM AR platform. And then for my sniper gun, I've kind of gone back and forth. Right now I'm back on a Remington 700 where I've kind of plussed up my chassis system. And I don't know. I had been on a gas gun for a little bit and then wasn't super thrilled with some of the grouping that I was getting out of it. And went back to the 700. But I think we're kind of in transition, looking at some other things. If AI wants to send me a gun, that would be awesome. I'd be super happy with that. The next greatest thing, I don't know. I know, you're talking to Vandy, I do really like the SIG, the Legion. It is a great shooting gun. It's probably just in my estimation, and I'm sure a lot of law enforcement folks will agree with me, you carry around so much stuff all the time that that duty belt, you start off and it's like the full bat belt with everything that you can possibly carry on it. And over my time, I've been doing this about 23 years, I need the lightest gear that I can carry. So that 19 just feels good on a day-to-day carry platform because it does sit on my hip, 40 plus hours a week.
shout out to my good friend, Pacifico Flores. He's on the Farmington PDs, one of their snipers. He has a range book for his rifle where, you know, you have to cut out or take a picture of your target. Do you guys still have that practice out there where you have to document everything through that firearm? Cause I don't think a lot of people realize that's a requirement.
We do. I'll do hand drawn, sketches, and I'm a little bit OCD where I'll do that on like a scrap piece of paper and then go back and put it in my book. But I have 15 plus years of dope books, you know, in my house, just as a history of what I've shot, you know, what the target was, what the conditions were, what my positioning was, any kind of time constraints that we put on them, any notes. I've started even adding stuff in as far as like, you know, this was after lunch and I felt like crap, you know, mm-hmm. We went and had giant burritos for lunch and now I'm, you know, running and then getting into a shooting position or it's, you know, it's so cold that I've got, you know, three giant puffy jackets on and that screwed up my positioning. So that I can look back and say, okay, well, I know that if I'm in similar conditions, you know, maybe fix some of those problems that I had last time.
What is it with marksmen and snipers and precision shooters? Like everyone tends to be a little OCD, actually a lot OCD. I mean, to the point where, you know, one of my shooting instructors, Dave Hinkle, said some guys will take like a hot glue gun and put a little dab of glue on like the forward of the comb and they're going to touch their cheek to that same spot. And it's like they've burnt into their memory that physical touch point on their cheek where it's going to be consistent every single time. And then, like you said, you've got, you know, the dope books. And, you know, I'm someone who I'm a Google Docs guy. I have a Google Doc for my shotguns. I have one that says like, okay, this shotgun is equipped with, you know, this optic. This is when I changed the batteries out. And then I've got one for my ARs. And I'm like, okay, when I chronoed it with, you know, Hornady Black, this is what it like, what is it with firearms where like, it's just like it's such a enabling activity for people that have those tendencies. Like what is it about it? Like, cause I mean, it seems like you have it just as bad as I do.
Yeah. I hate writing on anything other than graph paper. Like I like lines. I think it's
awesome. But yeah, I bet you're the type of person who, you know, if the TV is on, you got to have it on like 15 or 20, like the volume. Yes. It can't be on like 17. You know, that's just weird.
I'm very, yeah. I have now. You wouldn't notice from some of the like the messes I have around my house, but I know where everything is. Right? Like, I think it's all the process. Like, you get down behind, you know, that gun, you know, you check everything out before you get down behind it. You set up your perfect position. You get behind the, you know, the optic, you get the stock in your shoulder. It's all those things that you're doing, you know, you're managing your breathing. I'm sure you probably could be successful in some ways, of, you know, just go with the flow, jump down behind it. If you can see the target, press the trigger and, you know, gun goes boom and you get a hit. I think where you get people like in the precision lane or some of these other disciplines where it's, you don't want to hit the target. You want to hit the absolute dead center, or you're sending that 5-round group and you don't want them to be, you don't want a 1-inch group because that's a, you know, good metric for your gun or your ammo or whatever. You want the group where it is one hole with a grease ring, and anything beyond that is unacceptable to you as the shooter. Where, I mean, that is perfection, right? Like it's probably never going to happen with the combination of your ammo, your rifle, and, you know, what other metrics that are going to get in there, the shooter for sure. But it's that satisfying feeling of you're doing a process and then you're seeing the results. And I know, I mean, when we do precision classes, I try to tell people just like focus on one round at a time and don't start looking necessarily at the hits, because no matter what's going to happen, you're going to get like a 3 or 4 round group and you're going to start telling yourself like, man, this is going good. This is, like they're all touching. I'm going to put this on the fridge. Everybody's going to say how great this is. I'm going to put it on Instagram. And like, you start focusing on other things, or you start like thinking how great this group is going to be. And then you sure as shit are going to shank that one round and ruin everything.
Yeah. I think there's something to be said about, you know, that hard focus on that reticle. A lesson that came to me at SIG Academy during their 3-day intro to long range, the day one, at the end of day one, their activity is we're going to hang these little 1-inch price tags that are blowing in the wind. And they're like, you're going to shoot those. And we're like, the hell we are. Like, cause all of us doubted our ability because these things are turning sideways and now it's the width of a piece of paper and it's blowing in the wind and it's not steady. But you know, you, like you said, you learn the process, you learn to control your breathing. You learn, okay, I'm going to press the trigger, but if I don't press the trigger, I'm going to restart my process. And then, you know, one of the things that blew my mind was at the time when I took that class, I had a 3.5 to 10 on my rifle for optic. And the first time I did it, I'm like, crank it to 10. Right. And I was like, I'm going to shoot this damn thing. And then the instructor was like, drop it down to 3.5. And I dropped it down to 3.5 and I couldn't see my reticle perfectly over the, or I'm sorry, I couldn't see the price tag perfectly over the reticle, but at 10 I could. Yeah. And he's like, just hard focus on that reticle, hard focus on that reticle. And I forgot how many rounds it was. I think we shot 5-round groups at the target. And when I was on 10, I only hit it twice. But when I was on 3.5, I hit it 4 out of the 5 times. I was like, that's incredible. He goes, no. He's like, you're doing what you're supposed to be doing at 3.5. He's like, you're overly target fixated when you're at 10. And I'm like, duly noted, you know, like as magnification increases, everything seems to move. But at 3.5, it's like, man, that was like the magic number. And it was like, that's where the fundamentals are developed. I love it. It's a drug. I think precision shooting is a drug. You guys have my next fix, which if the company lets me, I want to fly out and train with you guys, cross train with you guys, where I'll pay for my flight on my own dime, if Fieldcraft won't. But tell me about the mid-range carbine class, because my first real exposure to that was with SIOC Tactical Group with their hybrid carbine. But then eventually I trained at Ridgeline Defense. I did their scoped carbine. I did SIGS Academy. But you guys have something special going on. Like what's the carbine class that the Colorado crew is pushing out?
So with ModTax range, we have the ability to get folks out to about 620 ring and steel. And I know you know this, but there is nothing more satisfying than getting down behind that rifle and going bang, and somebody's calling a hit before you hear the ting on that steel. And that, I mean, literally that just makes people like light up, you know what I mean? To see people who get those hits. So generally, you know, we're getting people out there. It's always interesting to see the gear that people come with. You know, sometimes people come with these guns and I'm like, man, that is going to rock, you know, and it's gun envy. That's for sure. Like that's the worst part of teaching classes is that you see all the gear that people show up with. And I'm like, now I have a new wish list. But you can test all those things and we'll usually make sure that everybody's good on paper. And, that's the hard thing, is everybody, you know, you get out to the range and you look and you see the array of steel that's out at distance and everybody knows, that's coming, you know, like that's in their future is hitting that steel, trying to drive people to the mentality of like, look, here's what we got to do first. We got to make sure that your rifle's zeroed. And then we got to make sure that you understand how to hit precision, right? So even at, let's say 50 yards, I want to spend some time and I want to dial in those fundamentals of precision. Because if you can't hit, say, the 1-inch target at 50, you're going to end up getting to a point, like when we push it out, that if you're not dialed in and you can say, well, yeah, I had a great trigger press. My reticle was right on that steel when I pressed the trigger. It was the wind, or I had the wrong dope dialed in. You're just making a pile of brass for nothing, right? I want you to be able to say, hey, I had the wrong wind call, but I know what that is. And my second round, I sent it and I got a hit. So we'll generally try to get people to the point where they are proficient at those closer distances, but on smaller targets, so that we can make sure that we're applying the correct fundamentals before we just start slinging lead, you know, and trying to hope, you know, hope and a prayer that we're hitting out at distance. So once we can get people out there, and once we can get people into a place where they know their dope on the steel arrays that we have, they're getting consistent hits, then we start looking at, you know, getting them into a little bit more realistic positioning, you know, where they might find. We have a lot of folks who come out who are, you know, hunters, or like that's their why behind coming to the classes. They want to push those platforms out for, you know, whatever game that they might be after. And, you know, it's you know, it's probably mostly unrealistic for any of us to think that we're going to have some scenario in our life where we're using a scoped carbine at 300 yards for self-defense, right? But start putting him into something where you're like, okay, if you do have to implement this out in the wild, right, out in the real world, for whatever reason, you're probably not necessarily going to always have a steady prone sandbagged position that you're going to take that shot from. So then getting him into some more real world application positioning, and then if we can get some time, then we're starting to do some running guns out in Dave's field and using fence posts for ad hoc, you know, positions, and challenging them to be creative to get those hits at sort of unknown distances as you're kind of moving between point to point.
One of the things I want to ask you about, because, you know, you said, you know, the whole idea of having hope that your round's going to hit, you know, and there's that old expression, you know, if there's lead in the air, there's hope in the heart. Well, speaking of that lead, a lot of guys are going to show up to that class, I'm assuming, if they've never did any research, probably with just like standard 55 grain, like M193 ball, but that's limited to a certain range because it's such a light round. Do you find, or I should ask, like, what do you think the max range is for, say, like 55 grain, 62 grain, 75? Do you have like a round that you recommend? What are your findings of like the ammo that we're using to feed our rifles when it comes to that mid-range or that long range for the platform, you know, carbine?
You know, I'm sure terminal ballistics are going to vary from round to round, you know, just based on like the engineering of it. I would say probably for coming to the class that your biggest issue is probably going to be, let's say, the person who's like scrambling to gather that ammo at, say, the last minute, right? They go to the gun shop and you need 300 rounds for the class, and you can get one box of 55 and three boxes of, you know, 75 and, or, you know, whatever. And you're mixing all these different rounds and you throw them all in a bucket, to take out there. The inconsistencies amongst that are going to be more difficult to deal with than, say, like that lighter round that's going to have different effects, right? Because you can, if your round is consistent, if you're buying a lot of, say, one round, well, I can start to figure out what that's going to do. Maybe that adjusts my dope. You know, if I've got a consistent velocity, I can start figuring those things out and can compensate for them. But if every round's kind of a guess as to what it may or may not do, that's, I think, where you're going to be on the struggle bus pretty hard.
Yeah. I think the AR is a very capable platform. The 5.56, a great round. You know, I think that what you are teaching people with the precision rifle, as you said, like, what's the why behind the shot? Like, if ever there's something that kind of transcends every one of those disciplines, like, I think you can learn the most from precision rifle more so than you can from handgun. Whereas, like, don't get me wrong, the handgun, you can learn a lot about shooting. But if you can learn to shoot a precision rifle well, you can take those principles and those fundamentals, apply them to a hunting rifle. You could take it, you know, precision rifle, and apply it to anything. And I think it is super rewarding. Of the classes that you teach, which is your favorite? Is it the personal defense? Is it the, you know, basic pistol? I mean, what is it and why?
Oh, that's tough.
I try to give you guys tough questions. You know,
this is like picking your favorite kid. Like, you don't want to say it to their face. You know, I like all the classes for probably a different variety of reasons. You know, the basic classes, I love seeing people like come out, be nervous, and then leave feeling more capable. You know, like putting that handgun, let's say, into their hands, and they're figuring it out. They're starting to get good hits. They're no longer, you know, sometimes people come and they're afraid of the tool and getting that proficiency. Mid-range and the long range stuff is probably always going to be a passion in my heart that I really love. The self-defense courses, we're just starting to get into those. And I honestly love seeing and Vandy and I were talking about this weekend, is that the women's only is a unique experience to teach, because you want to talk about like camaraderie and people having a shared experience and seeing people like gel in a class. You know, you'll take 15 strangers who show up to this class, and you know, there's always kind of the nervous whispering, and everybody's really, really kind of like they're whispering under their breath, like, do you think this is going to happen? What are we going to do here? And then you watch that class grow, and by the end, you know, they're laughing and joking and having a great time and taking it seriously and learning and building. That's a unique experience for me as a trainer. You know, the co-ed one is great, but it's always like guys approach training differently than women. You know, and I know you see this in your classes, is that the women will ask a ton of questions and the guys just kind of generally nod and don't they're not generally as open mm-hmm. as the women in the classes. You know, they're kind of standoffish is probably not the right word, but men definitely have more ego and they don't want to look bad in the courses, especially around strangers. Whereas women, I think, are more willing to kind of take that leap. So that makes it a unique experience for sure.
Yeah, there were a couple times on Sunday when I was like, hey guys, you have any questions whatsoever? And you could kind of tell like people were like reluctant to ask questions, you know, and I'm like, dude, anything? Like, I'm here. You know, you can ask me questions in private too, but I'd rather do it in person. I think you're spot on. If ego gets in the way, the questions won't be asked. And I think right. One of the greatest compliments to a teacher is when, you know, you say, all right, guys, does anyone have any questions? And the students are like, well, I knew you were going to be here, so I have questions ready. Cause then it's like, damn, this person came, they're ready to have their bucket filled with info, you know? Now we got to make a quick shift and transition, cause you know, we're coming toward the end of the podcast, but I got to ask, like, you know, in our AAR on Saturday, what was your favorite takeaway, or what were some of the things that you learned, you know, in my class on Saturday? This is just a purely ego driven question. I just got to hear some feedback. Like, what was your favorite thing about the modern survival skills class?
I had a great time, and we were talking on the way to the range. It's obvious that I have watched a ton of like survival shows, you know, like I didn't want to fanboy out too much in the car, but I was like, I have watched a ton of these shows. And then actually getting to put some of that into practical experience and having you actually show us how to do those things, you know, build the fire, make the feather sticks, which obviously I was terrible at. You know, getting to take theory into reality, I think was the best part, right? Like you gave us the theory, you showed us the technique, and now it was, hey, spend the next, you know, 20 minutes figuring out how to use these tools that we've already talked about. And this, you know, and kind of giving that chance for the students and, you know, obviously myself to take these things. Because I think it's probably, I would guess that of the students that were there, everybody has a garage full of stuff that they bought with, let's call it computer knowledge or TV knowledge, that they were like, oh, I need that piece of gear. I need this piece mm-hmm. of gear. And now you took everybody out and you're like, okay, let me show you how to actually use this thing that you just bought, or it's been sitting in the packaging because you didn't know how to use it. I thought that was awesome. And then kind of having that, I don't know if you could tell, but that water boiling challenge where I think it was Richard was like, done, you know, five minutes.
He was fast.
Like, that's cool. Yeah. I think legitimately I was the last person still trying to get that going. And probably my ego and my frustration of watching everybody else get it. And then I'm just like, okay, I've got a little bit of a flame going. I'm going to dump a bunch of stuff on there. And I was doing everything wrong, you know, but you didn't come over and be like, hey man, you're screwing this whole thing up. You allowed me to, like, it's probably a better lesson for me as the student to fail and then have people come and be like, okay, let me show you how you can do this better next time. If somebody comes over and just is like, hey, you're from the very get-go, you're doing this wrong. Well, I don't get that mental, like, mental learning point of like, this is what wrong is, this is what right is. You know what I mean?
Yeah. The training's the spot for, and I don't like using the word failure because training is the purpose of learning, but like, you, if you are going to fail, you fail forward. And yeah, you got to give the student an opportunity in a safe way. And that's a very low risk activity to just learn what works and what doesn't. And every once in a while, I went by one student. I'm like, hey, you're putting your cup here, but look at the direction that the flame is going. Right. And I'm not telling them like, put your cup in front. I just told them an observation and then they self-corrected, you know? But no, I think you're being hard on yourself. Like, you guys, just by the nature of where you're living out there, like, you guys already have a strong baseline of skills. And as you said, everyone's got that box of gear. We joked around and said it was the holster box, right? Stuff that, you know, we thought was the latest and greatest awesome thing, and it's just collecting dust. But no, I love having other instructors in my class. I love having, you know, students in my class like that. And as I said before, that Colorado crew is so damn cool. You know, and if you're an out-of-stater and you're questioning, like, should you go? I mean, I watched on Sunday, these guys had an issue with ammo. Like, there was an issue with the website, which I addressed on Friday, and we got the correct round count up on the website. Some students showed up with the incorrect amount. The student body was like, hey, I brought 500 rounds or 250 rounds. And like, they were so willing to work with one another and say, hey, you don't have enough, you can Venmo me. Like, people think that with an established crew, like the one that you guys have out there, that they're going to be clicky. And that was not the case. Like, there were new people. I said, who here is first class, right? There was this guy named Adrian and this guy named Mike first. Well, Adrian took multiple classes, but Mike, that was his first class. And he's like, dude, I'll be back. I'm like, thank you. You know, like, it was so cool. Wow. I think you guys are onto something out there.
And we have a great crew, 100%. But I think that's also the company, right? Like, people understand, like, it is a business, right? And the company is there to, at some point we have to make a little bit of money to keep the doors open. But I would say that all of the instructors that I know, all of the people, we want to take the students and make them better. And we want to form that community. And that's one of the things I love, is like, pretty much anywhere I've been, you can see that building, right? It's not one of those trainings where, you know, people were like, okay, I'm here for me and I don't really say anything. I might chat up one person, but I generally tend to see folks making relationships, making friendships, working together, you know, on the ranges, in the classes. And, you know, being here in Colorado, we get the chance to see the same people over and over again and build that up. But I think across the board, the people I see coming to our classes are in it for the community, not just for the class.
Yeah. And I think that's, that's something that, you take one class, you feel it, and you might've taken a while to come to the decision to take a class. But after that first class, the decision is very quick to take a second, you know, and just keep going. Yeah. You know, we're coming towards the end. I got to say one thing about, you know, just community and, you know, the folks that are out there. It's not just the students, it's the instructors. And something that you may want to recognize or not recognize, but I'm going to call you out for it. And it's such a good thing is, you know, many times when you go and train with an instructor, you know, we get wrapped up in the instructor's persona and you're like, okay, that guy's a really, really good shooter, or, hey, that guy's a really good, you know, primitive skills practitioner or whatever. And, you know, we get drawn to these people. And then it's disappointing when you find out that that person who is really quick or really, you know, passionate on the range or, you know, a great speaker, well, maybe they have a terrible home life and they're terrible to their wife or their kids or whatever. I was in the car with you and I'm just going to say, here's a little personal anecdote. I'm in the car with you and we're at the very end of the day and you're like, yeah, you know, my wife is going out and, you know, she's going to meet up with her friends and, you know, we're going to go meet up and my son just got this and that. Like, you have such a good balance of work, but also it seems like a very healthy and loving family. And, you know, I'll say that when I tell people, like, I love the people who I come to know at the company, because, you know, like someone like you, you're not just a great shooter, you're a good man. You know what I mean? And that's something that is so important, is that you surround yourself with people who are good people. Otherwise you pick up the bad habits of those who, you know, might be great in one domain of their life, but not great overall. And I would have no problem if someone said, hey, Kev, you know, Matt Shade needs this over here. I'd be like, you can trust him 100%. You can trust that guy because he's good all around, you know? And it's not like, again, I'm just saying, oh, he's a great precision shooter. Oh, but it's like, oh yeah, he's terrible with this. No, it seems from my interaction with you that everything's good. And I just encourage people to go and train with you because, you know, I respect you and I want you to continue doing well out there.
I appreciate you saying all that. And I have to be honest, when my wife was on the phone, I was praying because 99% of the time, if she knows that I'm on speakerphone in the car with somebody, she will try to say something just to utterly embarrass me to my core. And it usually has something to do with like dirty underwear or something like that.
Uh-huh.
So I was like, oh my God, please don't embarrass me. No, I think that, you know, we really try to strive to pick up good people. And I always want to be better, right? Like, I want to be a better dad and husband. I wish I had more time in the day to spread out my attention. And I definitely feel like I don't give certain aspects of my life and as much attention as I should and priority. And I want to do good for the company. I want to do good for my primary job and all of those things. And I think we as a company strive to pick up those people that, that draws the students in and makes them a good ethical person. Right. Like you said, like if I'm looking at people that I want to be on my personal SWAT team, or, you know, my home SWAT team, we can make people better shooters. We can make them, you know, we can get them in better shape. We can do a lot of things, but we can't make them a better person necessarily, right? Like, you want to surround yourself with those folks that you can trust with your life and trust that when you ask them to do something, they're going to do it and they're going to do it for the right reasons. I think as a whole, that's a good life philosophy, is, you know, surround yourself with people who make you better. And I'm really trying to do that. I want to be better as a person. I want to be better as a teacher. And, you know, like in our home little area, being surrounded, you know, with Vandy and Eric and Stevie B down in the Springs, just being better all around. And then, you know, when we extend out, you know, all the instructors that we have, obviously Mike and everybody at HQ, it makes us better and it makes us a stronger team for everybody to have that philosophy.
And since we brought up so many cheesy 80s and 90s movies, I might as well wrap this one up with a quote that ties to your point. Charlie Sheen said very famously in the movie Navy SEALs, "Trust me with your life, but not your money or your wife." I feel like that's appropriate right now. So is there anything that you want to say? Because, you know, you mentioned your wife. Do you want to give her a lovely shout out before we sign off here? And is there anything that she'd want to hear?
You know, Yoko, Yoko and I met when we were 19. I honestly could not do any of the things that I do without her. you know, she is my rock and my shield, and she supports me in every way possible. She's that kind of person, you know, that supports me when I need it and pushes me when I need it. So yeah, she has given me two wonderful children and makes home worth coming to every day. So she's wonderful.
Outstanding. Well, hey, where can people follow you? Where can people get in touch with you? Obviously they know they can go to the Fieldcraft training site and look at the classes that you're going to be putting on, but how can they get in touch with you if they want to ask questions about Colorado precision shooting or anything like that?
Yeah. Probably the easiest way is through Instagram. So it's Matthew Shea. So MatthewShay and the number 6 on Instagram. So yeah, shoot me a message. If I don't answer right away, sorry, I understand. I do have a full-time gig, just working at the PD. And if it, for whatever reason, is extended, I recently had a couple folks who had sent me a message and it just gets put in that like hidden, you know, you don't have any connections folder. And I found it probably a week late. So if I don't answer you right away, just send me another one and be like, hey man, look at my message above. Don't worry about harassing me. I'll do my best.
All right. Well, Matt, thanks so much for jumping on the podcast with us. I'm looking forward to coming back out to Colorado if I'm allowed to. And, absolutely. You know, we'll ring some steel, hopefully. I would be more than happy for you to spot for me, and I would do my damnedest to try to spot for you. But we'll catch up soon, I'm sure.
This was awesome. Thank you very much for having me. I really appreciate it.
Hey, thanks for jumping on. And for you guys listening, thank you so much for listening to the Fieldcraft Survival Podcast. Until next time.